I'm Levy Dalton, and this is I'll Drink to That, a bi-weekly program where we get behind the scenes in the wine business. Joe Salamone on the show today from Crush Wine and Spirits. Hi, Joe. How you doing?
Not bad. How about you?
Good to see you. Well, I mean, so email blasts, there weren't so many of those before you guys started up the shop. Has that always been a big focus for you, or?
For sure.
And how does that go down? I mean, like when you do an email blast, you focus on one wine or you focus on a producer? Or?
Often it's one wine. Sometimes we do producers. Frankly, the more options you give people, the more kind of they pull back and almost feel confused.
Oh, is that true?
For sure.
It's kind of like focus their interest on this topic and that whether that be one wine or two wines and kind of get them to make a decision.
Totally.
Oh, I didn't realize that that's how it went down. Are there other keys to like making a good email?
For sure. And you know, sometimes it's like we kind of send kind of somewhat informed spam and that people just look at the price and don't read the emails and whatever. But you can really tell when an email is well written, informed, seems to come from the heart. It does better.
Mm-hmm,
people
mm-hmm.
actually read them.
I feel like when I have seen you guys' emails that they've been pretty long and informative. Like there's a lot of information in there.
We definitely try. And you know, I write a good amount of emails and you can sink hours into it.
Is that true? Like especially if you have to do like research and stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. And often it's like you wake up every morning and you're like, how do I get this email together in a way that's informed, kind of lively and engaging? And it can be an adventure.
You know, one of the things I realized is that, so a lot of times we talk about like how the wine world has changed and how wines from everywhere sell now. But one of the things that occurs to me is that it's not like those wines are necessarily new wines or even new producers. It's just that they weren't being talked about before. And it really, it's more about now they're in the conversation. I'm talking about like Muscadet or wines from the Canary Islands or wines from Sicily. I mean, it's not like they didn't make wine there. It's just that they weren't being talked about. Do you see email blasts as a part of that in terms of getting that conversation started or continuing that conversation?
I mean, I think often it's the story that makes the sale. And
but what stories appeal? Is it about people or is it about places? I mean, when I say like that's limestone soil, does that appeal? Or when I say that this is a steep slope, does that appeal? I mean, what is it that resonates?
It really varies from wine to wine. To give an example, say Fernando de Castilla Fino.
Sure, the shares, yeah.
And you know, we worked with him directly for a while, and I bought a bunch. And at a certain point, I was like, "Ooh, maybe I made a mistake here." Like
in terms of how much stock you had,
yeah. And I was like, you know, the Spino is actually fascinating and mm-hmm. it's challenging and it's not for everyone. And it's made in a way that's completely kind of archaic.
A little bit higher alcohol, right?
Yeah, it gets two kind of doses of alcohol. You know, usually you get the dose in barrel when it starts to go into the Solera. Historically, you would get a second dose at bottling.
Okay. Like, so, historically, how many years ago are we talking about?
I think you'd be looking at the 50s.
Oh, okay. 1950s.
Yeah.
So some time ago. I mean, it's been a while.
For sure. Maybe it would stretch into the 70s. But
okay.
Once that ultra-filtered style came.
Of Fino.
Of Fino and Manzanilla.
Super clean.
Absolutely. Young. You didn't need, and as the technology for filtration increased,
got it.
That second dose of alcohol was meant to kill any flora that could develop in the bottle,
oh,
make
okay.
it more stable,
etc.
But talk about a story.
Yeah,
you know, this is kind of old school. Fino.
Not a lot of people are making it.
It's a relic. Yeah, he's virtually the only person.
And as sherry as a whole seems like a big story that you kind of got on a little bit earlier than some. Have you seen a big growth in that market?
Huge. I mean, I've kind of drank sherry since I've been serious into wine.
Yeah.
I was living in Berkeley. The Spanish Table was there. I think the New York Times ran an article, a tasting panel on finos, how great they were. So I started drinking them, and they're at my disposal. So
And they're cheap,
it
or were cheap,
exactly.
or
And still good values. And
yeah.
I mean, what an Ascendi goes for is
Is pretty
that's cheap.
ridiculous, yeah, for the quality.
And so I always wanted to champion sherry.
Yeah.
It was always a dog.
Yeah, they just didn't get the resonance.
And then it's hard because there's no vintages. So there's no, it's hard to figure out a way to hype it in a way because
Right. Hey, this is new, doesn't work for that.
for sure, and it's not limited.
Right,
It's
right,
like,
right.
oh, well, if I skip it this time,
I can just get it later or
get the
whatever.
next bottle in.
Right.
And when Labota came out,
Oh,
they were
okay.
stunning. There was a sense of limitedness,
Got it.
got people talking.
I didn't even put that together that was part of it, that the limited part, you know, was a big thing.
For sure. And especially distribution wasn't great for the first few years.
It was terrible, yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And now it's gotten better, but there are more people. But that got people talking again. And
Trying to hunt them down and
for sure. And at one point, I secured a good amount of 24, which was the Fino Amontillado from Montilla,
Okay.
and 22, which was a Manzanilla. And we sent out an offer, and it went pretty gonzo, or I don't know. It did well.
It did well, yeah.
And I was like, maybe this is a good time.
Yeah.
And Kresh was like, sure, like, do you want to go there? And I was still skeptical.
Yeah.
And I actually put it in part of a personal vacation. So the business was a kind of pain for
For
everything. Because
everything.
I was like, I don't know what the return on this is gonna be. Like,
Yeah.
you send me out there and we sell four cases.
Right, you might be a little upset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But pretty incredible.
Like, how would you describe what's happening with sherry right now in the New York market?
It seems like it's grown huge. And distribution has changed. Vadispino is now with Planner Selections, who has a great reach and has a good sales team,
Which is something
respected.
that Val d'Espino didn't have for a
No,
long time.
for ages, I was one of the only people in New York with it
Yeah.
because I had to seek it out from some dude.
Yeah. Fernando de Castilla, I've
For
heard
sure, David
interest
Zoller.
from two different importers recently. Like one called me and was like, "Hey, I talked to Fernando de Castilla and they said they already just went with somebody else." Like that seems surprising to me, you know what I mean?
For sure. So a huge amount of interest. Certainly Peter's book.
Peter Leem,
Peter
a
Liam's book,
previous
which
guest on the show.
is just kind of getting released today and then kind of more officially Monday.
But a lot of people release books. I mean, what is it about sherry that has really catapulted it to the interest of the forefront and kind of the New York scene amongst younger people right now?
I think it's complicated. It's a new frontier. It's ex extreme. It's somewhat of an underdog. And everybody kind of likes to fight the good fight. I mean, you have vineyards just, being taken over by golf courses and solar panels and
There's a sense that we're losing something if we don't step up to preserve it.
for sure. And then you have people who've been there who are really excited about it. And that helps. Also, I think things have really changed in the wine business. Say when Crush opened in 05, you'd get calls like, hey, I'm calling about this like Prüm offer. These wines the best because I only buy the best.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know how to answer that, dude.
Yeah,
They're
because
good. Like,
there's a lot of Riesling. And they're different in how they taste.
people would very much want it the best.
Yeah.
And this is, say, 05, like the kind of plush oaked up styles that you could associate with Parker were definitely big. Australian wine was still big.
Yeah.
And really it started to shift where all of a sudden Joe Dresner was very important. people didn't look for the best. They looked for a unique experience. They looked to kind of expand. There's a curiosity, a playfulness.
Oh, so
orange wines. I mean, Grafner's first vintage was 01, where he did full-on skin contact, and that was probably November, December of 05 that he released it.
So you think more of an interest in something distinctive and possibly unique as opposed to the greatest?
For sure. And the idea of experience and being receptive to it.
And maybe a little bit more emphasis on this comes from that place in particular.
Absolutely.
And do you think that that is kind of like an extrapolation of the Burgundian idea? Like the idea of like one terroir, one man, one place?
For sure. And also it's somewhat part of, for lack of better term, this zeitgeist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Farm to table.
Mm-hmm.
How many people are making kind of very good pickles in this country now?
Yeah.
And that kind of blew up at the same time and wanted some sense of immediacy and kind of honesty and soul to things, or that perceived quality.
Does it seem like people want a particular person to be behind the wine and also at a small scale? Sometimes I feel like by virtue of being larger, some of the more classic wines, like by virtue of being larger producers, are being less and less esteemed.
For sure. I mean, Roeder, Champagne, Vintage.
Pretty good wine.
Yeah, yeah. But it's hard to convince people, big house, but not a top, it's not Clos de Menil or something that's perceived as a blue chip great wine, for sure.
And what you mean is it's hard to convince people that it's in the league of the growers.
Yes.
Whereas that conversation might have been like the opposite 10 years ago.
For sure.
Like you might have had a hard time convincing somebody that the grower champagne
was
some
quirky
good
guy who kind of makes champagne in a slightly idiosyncratic style. Yeah, that was a much tougher sell.
So, I mean, do you think it's the zeitgeist, or I mean, what has caused this change to happen? Are we trying to get back in touch with something that may have lost in the culture, or what's going on?
I mean, I don't know for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think part of what happens is people need novelty.
Uh-huh.
They need stuff to get excited about.
Yeah.
They also need stuff to kind of push away to differentiate what they care about.
I see.
And, if you read Kermit Lynch's like Adventures Along the Wine Route.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite titles, books. Yeah.
I think that's from 84.
Yeah.
I could be mistaken, but
it's 80s. 80 something. 82.
All of this stuff had been in play, but it slowly got a bigger market share. And there are plenty of people writing about wine that said, wait, you know what, like oak, ripe fruit, it's not, I want wine with more soul, more honesty.
Not something that can be done everywhere. So it's kind of the opposite of the fighting varietals. Like, hey, you could make Merlot here, you could make Merlot there, you could make Merlot there.
For sure. I think like Eric Asimov's writing really reached a lot of people with this kind of aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
And he publishes on a weekly basis. So it's kind of like it hammers home. It gets more and more people.
So it's not like a quarterly thing, or, you don't have to be online in a specific wine forum. You might just be paging through your paper and there's this content. And so by virtue of that, it reaches a lot of people.
For sure.
And it seems like you have been kind of ahead of the game in identifying things that later became popular. And I would say that that in particular, you, maybe even apart from the store, have driven some of those moves. Like you've did it through the store, but I really associate certain things with you. Like I feel like you were one of the people that was very early onto Ganavat, I feel, which is now quite popular. I feel like you had a big hand in bringing Mach wines from the Jura to the market when they weren't really around, and now they're quite more well thought of and kind of more current in the market. Same thing with Metra. I feel like you sort of had a big hand in bringing that in when it was not being brought in from the Beaujolais area. What is it that you think separates a buyer who is breaking new ground from a buyer who isn't? And how is it that you've managed to pick a few things that have later become, as we might say, picking a good horse?
I mean, in some ways, I was lucky. Some ways that as not concrete as this is, I often have good instincts. I also work for a place that has enough money that I can play with it,
You can make a move.
and I'm given a huge amount of autonomy there. So that's for sure. Other things, I just kind of read. Somehow I feel like I'm compensated well enough that, or maybe it's because I live somewhat of a modest lifestyle, but I was able to travel and, read like crazy, read up on regions, really digest a huge amount, and then be there and just rip through everything I don't know, talk to people, and kind of pull stuff from there.
So let me ask you, I mean, how many more times can this trick happen? I mean, it's one Earth. I feel like now that we've gotten to the Canary Islands, what more is there to find? I mean, are there hidden vines on Easter Island? Are there hidden vines on the Galapagos that we don't know about? I mean, I feel like a lot has
No, I.
been reached. Are there more frontiers or things that we're just ignoring that are in our backyard? How many more times are we going to be able to find an a Ganavant level producer?
I mean, so one reason to be optimistic is that there's more commercial or financial incentive for people to work that hard in these places. There's a lot more now than there maybe has ever been. So that's good.
Someone might look at what say Jean Foyard is doing and say, "Hey, that's working. He's doing
For
okay, so
sure.
I can try something like
I
that."
mean, Ganavant, he's never impressed me as a wealthy man. There's not, a Porsche parked outside, and his yields are low, and he's kind of so committed to quality. But the wines aren't cheap. I mean, 45, 60, 100 bucks.
But they've gone up a bit, I mean, in the
Oh,
last
for
2 years, even.
yeah. No denying that. He's able to do it.
Yeah, so it's possible.
For sure. I mean, it's interesting because I do wonder to some extent the wine world has is factionalized,
Is that true?
a little bit, but not as much as you would assume. Like I do feel like that maybe it's just because where I work, what I deal with, it's specific. And for a while we had Australian wine, New World wine, and we still have some California wine, but it's clearly not our focus. And if you go into the store and you dig this stuff, you're gonna be like, ugh.
And
Like,
you feel like there's other shops that do that for people, and so you mean that, like, by factions, these guys kind of deal more old world, these kind of guys do more new world.
yeah, maybe that's true, and I just can't see the big picture. But I do think, in recent years, there's been a paradigm shift, and that this style of wine has become so dominant for people that maybe, like you said, maybe we have almost milked it for all it's worth.
And what is that going to mean for, I mean, because it seems like more and more importers are getting into the business. Are they going to be able to find something to bring back, or am I just being overly pessimistic, or what is the reality?
I actually think because there is some money in it, that you will find wines that will be very, very good, perfectly serviceable kind of table wines, like drink every day, cellar some. Will like another Clos Rougeard pop up, or another Versailles or Ganavant? In one way, you never know until they do. You're always kind of blindsided by these people. But I do think that so many people are importing wines, so tentacles are kind of everywhere. And I haven't seen kind of the next big thing for a while. because people have just spent the past 5 years turning over every stone.
It seems like some of the conversation now is even shifting away from how distinctive things are to how everyday they can be.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that too? I sometimes get a hint that people are just looking to have a glass of wine now.
I see that less because I think a lot of our client base, especially the ones that I interact with on a daily basis, buy more wine than they can drink.
I see.
And the idea of like, oh, is this just a good wine to have around? It's like, I have wine coming out of my ears.
Yeah.
Like, that's the last thing I
need. It's not in some way special, they're not taking it on.
For sure. And also can age because it's going to go into their storage.
They might not get there for a while.
Yeah.
So how did you get started in the business?
Oh, God. So I cold called Crush.
Yeah.
Which right before the holiday season in 05.
Okay.
They had opened in March, so it was very much a new business. I actually got the somebody was like, hold on. I got the GM on the phone. And he's like, okay. Like, I'd never worked in wine before, but had spent at least 3 years, you know, drinking around and kind of becoming obsessed enough to be willing to take the plunge.
Okay.
And he was like, okay, so what was the last bottle of wine you drank?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, like I had 02 Diachen Franc de Piette last night.
Oh, yeah?
And he was like, okay, like come in for this interview.
Yeah. I'll see you on Wednesday then. Yeah.
And perfect, you know, perfect answer. And at this point, I knew wine, but I learned it pretty much in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
I'd worked for someone at my teenage job who I'd gotten pretty close with and, you know, bought cheap, like Grateful Dead tickets for him and hung out with his family. And he had worked for Wildman back in the day when they had DRC, Lefleve. And he actually had DRC, Lefleve, lots of Penfolds Grange.
Oh, he'd bought a few bottles to sock away.
For sure. And he'd won sales contests and whatever else. Like he opened up my first bottle of DRC 85 Romney County.
Pretty good one.
Yep. I mean, it made everything else I drank up until then seem like 5 week old grape juice.
Yeah.
I mean.
And so you went through and what happened in the interim? What you were doing like teaching and personal training and
Yes, I actually spent years as a bodybuilder, as a teen, and we can return to that if you want, because it may actually have relevance. And then after college, I'd planned on applying to law school. Had worked with kids and taught. I TA'd and tutored in college, and then worked at a Fresh Air Fun Camp for summers. And I took a job working first with kids with emotional disabilities and then kids with autism. And really wanted to do that for a few years as something I enjoyed, something I
felt. What are the good takeaways of that?
Honestly, a lot of it had to do with how to approach people, how to speak. Usually when I make requests on people, they do it.
Yeah.
And there's a way of delivering stuff that's so neutral and well-reasoned and that, you know, it's the way you would talk to kids with emotional disabilities who,
got it.
You know, really are at, you know, about to flip out, can have the potential to flip out at any second. It was also, I went to school for philosophy and comparative literature. So there's no special ed training in my background. I just worked with kids from the inner city and
kind of saw what worked.
Yeah. And I had good mentors and, both of my jobs, I actually applied for a teacher's aide position And somehow they liked me enough to give me a teacher's position. I don't know what I said in those interviews.
Dear but... Sean. You're like, Dear Sean Frank DePede. And they're like, well, clearly you're teacher material. No, I'm just kidding. But so you mentioned about the personal training. How do you think that that may have played into your own history?
I was a competitive power lifter.
Okay.
And I wanted to do bodybuilding. And this was from 14 to 17.
Got it.
And it's kind of a bizarre and seemingly incongruous fact about me, because today I'm 148 pounds, 5'5". When I was 17, I was 205.
Oh my God.
I was probably skinnier than I am today. And it's easy to look at weightlifting and think it's just kind of boneheads lifting weights, but it's actually more complicated than that.
How does that play out?
I mean, simply put, weightlifting is an adaptive response. To build muscle, it's an adaptive response mm-hmm. from your body. So, you burn yourself, you get calluses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You lift weights, it's too much weight than your body's used to. You get bigger muscles. But your body also wants to maintain some sense of homeostasis.
Like that it's not all crazy all the time.
For sure. Like it just wants to kind of have some type of baseline kind of normalcy. And that's what one of the things you have to really battle. I spent years reading up on all kinds of theories, and a lot of them, lots of physiology, lots of kind of biochemistry. And I was young and, some of it was watered down, but there was a sophistication there.
Yeah. Because people have an interest in this. People want to do
this.
Oh,
yeah. People. Yeah,
there's a lot of people who want to build muscle.
It's a real kind of subculture.
Yeah. Kind of like wine in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, when I look at magazines and stuff that aren't necessarily weightlifter magazines, I see like these, like how to build muscle things, and they seem like bullshit. Is that?
And that's, I'm really happy I went through the weightlifting period.
Uh-huh.
I ate 10 times a day, 10,000 calories a day, worked out anywhere from 3 times a week to 6.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it really claimed, a lot of my teenage years.
Yeah.
It was not a normal kind of high school experience. When I see people who a lot of people who I respect in wine, when you talk to them, you always find out that they like collected records for 15 years, or you're obsessed with neorealist film or new wave film. And I think that, wine isn't astrophysics, but it does place demands on people.
Uh-huh.
Memory, just learning the field of what's important, vintages, all of that. And
there's a lot to know.
For sure. And there's also just a lot of noise.
Oh,
and
I
there's
see.
There's a lot of stuff like...
A lot of hype.
For sure. And there's a lot of stuff that, it's very hard to taste and be attentive.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes you're late. Sometimes you're waiting for an email. There are people who, if they say they like a wine and I taste it, it's hard for me to taste it. And I respect them.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to taste it and not want to like the wine.
Right. I find that too.
And one thing that there are at least 3 things that I think we lived and did. One is that it really does, like a lot of sports, force you to have a connection with your body.
Oh, okay.
And force you to pay attention.
Oh, okay.
You want to know how the workout routine is working. When you do exercises, they're for particular muscle groups. Like, if you do it right, you should be like, I can feel it here, and I know what's happening. And when it comes to tasting, you kind of need that much, like, this is what's happening here.
You need to be in tune with
the
senses.
Absolutely. Wines show different days. Not every bottle is the same. Different glasses. Sometimes a wine just lands, and it's not bottle shocked. It's bizarrely open. And you kind of have to be attentive to all of these things. And some of it is that base knowledge, and some of it is just paying attention.
Mm-hmm. How important do you think paying attention is in a business? I mean
to be able to objectively, you know, figure out what's up with a wine, huge.
Mm-hmm.
It's also really hard.
Uh-huh.
I would say you fail way more than you succeed in a way.
So is it kind of like ignoring those bullshit ads about weightlifting and whatever?
For sure.
Is that the same thing? Like you have to ignore the sales spiel?
Yeah, to some extent. And also it's a discipline.
Mm-hmm. Really focusing in.
For sure. And then back to the weightlift, and you know, there's so much information that I feel like you do build a capacity when you've done stuff like this in the past, that it's almost like a generalized skill.
So collect. When
you approach wine, you approach wine, you're able to remember all of this craziness.
Mm-hmm.
And having focused so much, no matter what you do, there's always hype. And mm-hmm. stuff, and there's also a maturation process where it becomes like an individualized, like, I like this,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't like this, like, I get why people like whatever, but this is kind of what I look for.
Yeah.
Because
there is in the market a difference between, you know, what other people might buy and what you might like, or
for sure.
And you have to kind of keep your own palate while understanding that you're marketing to people who may not share it, I guess.
Totally.
So who does succeed in retail? I mean, you know, here you worked your way up from a guy who did stock and sales at Crush to a guy who does a bulk of the buying at a major shop in Manhattan, you know, which is, I think, a national player. You know, who does do well, and who maybe leaves that to go into restaurants or in some other part of the wine market? I mean, what are the characteristics of people who are drawn to retail?
I mean, I think retail, a lot of it is the schedule is attractive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think, you know, you work at a restaurant, you get to taste more. Often I do believe that there's a little bit more money to be had in restaurants.
Oh, is
that
true?
Might be mistaken. I feel like that might be. But also in restaurants, it's even more grueling than retail.
Just like crushing hours.
Yeah.
Because you have to do the stuff that's all the buying, like, around the floor service. Like, you can't do the buying while you're on the floor, I guess.
For sure. And there's a huge amount of pressure involved. And there's also, like, you have to look, you have to be dressed very well often.
Uh-huh,
I mean, I think that's tamed down in recent years, but...
Like, the look, whatever it might be, is important.
Yeah.
Whether it's the hipster look or the... That's more of a restaurant thing. Like, you have to have a look.
For sure. Also, I think retail is where people grow roots.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Most people who get into a good position in retail stay there.
And that might be 10 years at a shop, or it might be, you know, however long.
For sure.
Whereas some of them obviously stick around for a long time, but others tend to be kind of nomadic. Like, you're like, oh, that dude's not here anymore? Oh, okay.
Totally.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. So, well, let me ask you, though. I mean, here we talked about the differences in what it's like to work in retail and restaurants, but have we seen the kind of items that are available in restaurants also migrate more to retail? Like, when I talk to you, I talk to a retailer that's like breaking new wines into the market that weren't even available in the States. Now you've brought them in. Didn't that seem like not too long ago, like something that maybe an importer might have done? And if an importer didn't do it, it was more of a restaurant thing. I mean, is this kind of new for retail?
Yeah. I think it is. Partially, I think part of the increase of email blasts.
Uh-huh.
You're able to expose numerous people to wines in one shot.
Like, you're able to have a long conversation with them in a focused manner that you may not have if they're just coming in looking
totally.
For something off the street.
And one email, you can have a conversation with a lot of people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yeah, so, you know, you spend 4 hours making it, but you have that level of conversation with 1,000 people.
For sure.
Which you couldn't do in
person.
And
you also, build up a level of trust. And I know you can do this in the restaurant business, but I think more people buy wine more often from a particular retailer than they do from a particular restaurant.
Because maybe their wife or a business guests want to go to new places,
For sure.
whereas they might return all the time to the same retailer.
Yeah.
That's
Or
interesting.
shop with three or four.
And but I mean, have now that there's less kind of allocated items, has the landscape of what retail does shift somewhat in the sense that are you selling more high ticket items? I know that's not your so much your buying field, but does retail sell more high ticket items, whereas maybe once that was more the province of restaurants?
Honestly, I'm not sure because I'm not sure what happens at restaurants. Crush was always conceived to be somewhat of an edgy, on the forefront, mid-range type of place and a high-end place.
Oh, I see. So from the beginning, it was like,
Certain, yeah.
but did that feel like kind of a new thing?
For sure.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of took two models, the kind of small, like artisanal grower model, and then also the ultra high-end model.
So what's the difficulty when you're dealing with ultra artisanal wines to keep things in stock? Does that mean that you're always kind of like chasing the next thing because you might blow through the 10 cases that were available?
For sure. And
Like,
also it's, like Ganabat, I see less as he gets more popular.
yeah.
I see less of it every year.
In a way, are you like grooming your prodigy there to leave? Like, are you like setting up things that you really admire and praising them and then watching them get too expensive or too limited to sell?
So yes, yeah. I mean, sometimes, you just can't offer wines that were offered 2 years ago. You can't offer, you can let people who know bought who bought them previously that they're there, and then you have to find something new.
Oh, you're saying that like you can't send out an email blast because the quantity is so
So
little
small,
that
yeah.
you would have to turn away more orders than
For
would be
sure, it'd
worth
be an
it.
exercise in frustration for the customer, for the staff. Demand would be so high.
So, I mean, is that ever frustrating where you're like, boy, I really made this wine or in this market,
Oh,
and
for
yet
sure.
now I can no longer buy it? Is that ever a problem?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, in some ways it's good for the grower, and you want to be happy about that. And
Because they're making more sales and more money.
yeah. And also, if it's in one place where it's a little bit more limited how word gets out. And then you're also reliant on, one, three, four, five people to sell your wine more. If it's spread more and more people are exposed.
Maybe people call you to ask you if you have it, that kind of thing.
For
If it's out
sure.
in a, if it's hip in the community.
Yeah. And on the other side, you feel like you kind of own this. And from a business perspective, you're like, I could be making money on this. It feels like a legitimate claim that like I really put my neck out.
But you're someone that also like goes out a little bit and you go to restaurants. I mean, when you look at some of the lists that are happening in New York, maybe downtown or in Brooklyn, does it feel like restaurants today are focusing on what might have traditionally been retail items? Like items that would go on a list under $100 that they're maybe buying for 20, 25 wholesale?
For sure.
So is it almost kind of like a switch in a way? Like where retail is doing more adventurous work and maybe more high-end work? For people don't want to pay the margin that you would have to pay in a restaurant, and restaurants are moving more towards items that you might have purchased at the store at one time.
I that has to be. And more, I think restaurants have smaller budgets for this stuff. It opens up a huge amount of creativity. Drinkers are younger, and they want to experience these things, but they can't cough up the dough for that much. And you don't have money to build a cellar. So you focus on wines at gentle price points. Often natural wines drink earlier and easier, and you focus on that, and it works well.
What do you think about the natural wine kerfluffle? I mean, what's going on with that in the market, and who's driving that? Is it driving from the importer side, or is it driving from a consumer's desiring it side, or what's actually happening?
It has to be both. I mean, the natural wine movement is somewhat of an extension of that paradigm shift we talked about earlier, where people wanted stuff that was more honest, more immediate. And the idea of lower sulfur, organic, natural yeast, it's all the idea is that it's almost closer to, the grapes fermented. You put in grapes, they ferment, you put them in the barrel, and you take out wine.
So it's almost closer to what the winemaker himself tastes when he tastes into his own
For
winery in
sure.
the barrel. So it's
Yeah.
almost kind of like giving you a glimpse of being a winemaker in a way, like you're right there in the
A
cellar.
sense of immediacy. And some of those wines can be the purest, most delicious wines. They're tricky wines. It's gotten trendy, which, difficulty there is make a natural wine. Natural wines are some of the most difficult to make. And so when you have a trend, you have people who want to make wine
Oh, I
like
see.
this, but it demands so
Because
much
there's
of,
market interest.
yeah.
But you have to be attentive to things that could go wrong because so much more could go wrong.
For sure.
Because you're not dosing it with things that would
Stabilize
stabilize it.
for sure. And that's kind of my only issue. I mean, in general, I'm very supportive of it. But when, because of the demands it places on winemaking, and honestly, like it's one of those things that occasionally you're gonna mess up. That there might be, I would say my only concern is that they proliferate to a point where not everything is wonderful.
So, I mean, you guys do deal with some high-end sales. Is it true at retail? Like I hear at restaurants that Bordeaux is just not an interesting category to consumers anymore, or what's going on with that?
What I experienced, people aren't, not that many people are calling up and being like cases of cases and cases of Bordeaux. We have some people, but I think a lot of the action has moved to Burgundy. But then, as far as people coming in to buy a bottle of Bordeaux to drink, there's tons of interest there.
Oh, is that true?
For
Like
sure.
something that's mature enough to be ready to drink in just one bottle?
Yeah, or a couple bottles. But I think whereas California wine and Bordeaux, for a lot of people who were beginning to feel affluent and you're in a hedge fund and you've kind of arrived. 5, 10 years ago you would look at Colt Cabs and Bordeaux. Now you look at Burgundy.
I see. So it's
I would
really
say
become the new
speaking
blue chip.
broadly, from what I've seen, yeah.
And do you think that's in a way social? Like if a guy shows up with a Burgundy, that's more in the club than if he shows up with something else to the business dinner with the other guys?
Yeah, for sure.
So what are you drinking at home these days?
Oh God. All sorts of things. Often, and I really do try to drink a fair amount of what I buy at the store and track it and have a good feel for it. 'Cause you taste stuff, you buy it. It's like often it's like one or two tastes.
You want to sit with it for a while, see how it develops with dinner.
Exactly. In the summer I frankly don't drink a lot of wine. I don't think wine shows that well. And in the humidity and in the heat, I'm often so disappointed that I'm happy to almost use it as a vacation from wine and drink beer, drink some Fino sherry, Manzanilla sherry, and be happy. What am I drinking now? Now that it's fall, I am drinking some Jura wines. Beaujolais.
How have you seen the change in the Beaujolais market recently? Does it seem to be different than it was just a couple of years ago?
For sure. I mean, I think 05 was an important year as far as getting more people aware of it, and then 09 really blew it up. And I mean, what you hope as a retailer is that when you have these blockbuster vintages, like 01 Germany or 09 Beaujolais, where the public wants them, that you're able to situate enough producers who you think really do good work every year, that you retain some of the people year in, year out.
Do you feel like a lot of people like lurch from one big topical issue to another?
I mean, it's an issue because, I mean, we're just so bombarded with information. And when enough people say that this is like the best ever, or this is a special vintage, how can you not jump on that wagon?
Everyone buys in onto, 2005 Burgundy, 2001 Germany, 2009 Beaujolais. But do they stay in the market, I guess is the question.
I think more and more I have seen people stay.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were to look at numbers, you would see a dip,
Yeah.
but you would also see a trend that shows an increase.
In general, like people are going back to it. And is that partly because other Burgundies, then, because Beaujolais, after all, is kind of part of Burgundy? Is that just because those have gotten so expensive and people want the Burgundy hit without laying out 100 or?
Partially, I think that helps. Also, the natural wine movement arguably started in Beaujolais,
Yeah, sure. People like Lapierre.
for sure, and Chauvet, and I think it picks up a lot from there.
I see.
And also,
Maybe especially amendable to Gamay.
and when you ask me like what I'm drinking these days.
Yeah.
Occasionally, I had an 83 von Schuber Absberg Auschlies.
Pretty good. Yeah.
Gorgeous.
Kind of sorry I missed that dinner at your house.
But then often that, for me, wines kind of work on two levels, or maybe three. Like you cook a good meal at home, you have a simple wine. And the two really add up to something that like makes life seem worth living
Yeah,
for
pleasure.
like
Yeah.
that period of time. There's stuff that's just kind of fascinating and kind of mind rearranging. And then there's the stuff that's just gorgeous and at the top of the hierarchy in a way, and
Pristine and
profound. Trust me, I'm happy to drink as many profound wines as I can track down, and people
Yeah.
will open for me. I'm also happy to have a bottle of Beaujolais with the right meal, and
Roast chicken.
like as chaotic as my life has been lately with just work, I'm kind of happy there.
Yeah, there's a rusticity to a simple table meal.
And in some ways, this is a footnote to your conversation earlier about restaurants. Having more kind of mid-range bottles that are, like nice table wines, simple table wines. They really have a place, and in some ways, they're pretty appropriate for restaurants.
Like because the cuisine is so like profoundly worked, like because it's so working on so many levels on the plate, it's actually easier to pair like a fairly simpler wine sometimes.
For sure. And it's also often easier to serve that. You don't have to worry as much about decanting
The
or,
perfect moment because food's coming and you got to serve it. Like, let's get it going on a table.
exactly.
That's really interesting.
And maybe that gets back to your, like, have you seen people who just really want a glass of wine?
Because I wonder sometimes if people aren't kind of tied into the glue natural wine movement, if people aren't just looking to have a glass of wine that's maybe not profound one day. Like,
For sure.
I don't know. Maybe I don't know. I start to hear people talk about that. Mr. Salamone, a pleasure to have you on the show, sir. Joe Salamone of Crush Wine and Spirits, a guy that you should get to know if you don't already, because you will drink better. All Drink to That is recorded with the great assistance of executive producer Matt Ducker, and also with the great help of our guests and listeners. Thank you for joining us. You can catch us online alldrinktothatpod.com, no apostrophe, alldrinktothatpod.com, or on Twitter at drinktothatpod. And you can find us on iTunes. You should subscribe. Tell us what you think in a review. Subscribe on iTunes. Thank you for listening.